Lecture 17, Tolstoy, War and Peace, Part 2.
In this second lecture on War and Peace, I want to repeat a quote from Paul, Corinthians 13, that I already cited once. Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. And I suggested that that is a diagnostic paradigm, but I also want to say that it marks, it seems to me, the path of discovery, self-discovery for Tolstoy's characters. And his character is going to be largely the topic of this lecture, that the first lecture I gave was more on the design of the book and also of Tolstoy's suspicion of pattern and form and order. It's as if the last lecture were the hedgehog lecture. Now I'm going to give you a fox lecture where we're going to look at the individual figures. His are among the most remarkable characters, I think, in literature. Because even though we may be, as individuals, the ingredients of history, marionettes on some huge stage that we don't control, that doesn't make our own drama and our own experience of things any less moving or real. And it has a great pathos and beauty in War and Peace. I think Tolstoy is a giant among novelists because of the roundedness and depth and reaches of his characters and the evolving and twisting and separating and then relinking plot that brings these people back and forth like a dance. That doesn't mean that we love these characters. My wife once said to me, you know, Tolstoy's characters are like a family that you live in. You know them very well. You can't quite live without them, but you don't particularly love them all the time. And I think that there's a sense here in which these characters are flawed. They're not perfect. They're not meant for our admiration. But nonetheless, they're engrossing. We stay with them as we read this book. So let me start and devote most of the lecture to the trio that sort of stands out in this book. Prince André, and then Pierre, and then Natasha. André Bolkonski is dashing, brittle, ambitious, a hero of willpower, an admirer of Napoleon, brave, yet lucid, self-aware. He wants freedom at the early part of this book, and he wants it because he's tied down and bored by his wife, Lisa. In fact, he urges his friend, Pierre, never marry. You give up all your freedom. He feels that he's got a harness on him, that the kinds of grand things that he wants in his life are not going to be possible. So as you might well imagine, war is going to be a fabulous opportunity for André. And he comes to life in war. Tolstoy writes what it feels like for him in one of the first battles. He says, if I want glory, if I want to be famous and loved by everyone, it's not my fault that I want this, that this is all I care for, the only thing I live for. And in this passage, he goes on to say that he knows that if he dies, it will be terribly, terribly painful, unsurvivable perhaps, for his own loved ones. That these are the people, his mother, his father, or not his mother, but his father, his sister, they're the ones that are dearest to him, his wife even, he says. And yet, nonetheless, all of that is eclipsed by the kind of fervor he feels about risking his life on the battlefield and achieving glory. To be loved by men I don't even know and never shall know. It's an interesting phrase. He's quite aware of the absurdity of this. And yet, there it is, irresistible, drawing him. There's a kind of clarity, but clarity doesn't seem to interfere with intensity here. At Austerlitz, he is wounded, and he experiences the kind of quintessential Tolstoyan discovery of the truth that lurks behind our ordinary daily illusions. I probably overstated that. Not necessarily a truth behind our illusions, but it's a discovery of something beyond the way we ordinarily live. He discovers it in a posture that most of us might discover something, which is he's wounded and lying flat on the ground. You see things in a different way. You see different things when your body is flat on the ground and you can't move it. You see the sky. And you see it in a way that you rarely see it when you're standing up. And he is aware that he's never seen the sky before. Never like this. How can it be that I've never seen that lofty sky before? And it gives him a feeling of great plenitude, even though he's wounded and thinks he's dying. How happy I am to have found it at last. I think this approaches, but is not quite a religious perception. There's no God necessarily in it. It's rather the grandeur, the magnificence of the world itself, that somehow, through our own routines and habits, perhaps through the skin that binds us and bounds us, we're sealed off from, customarily. And only in moments of great peril, crises, perhaps disaster, perhaps impending death, does the veil lift, the curtain open, and we see. Well, Andre is destined to be wounded more than once. In the scene that I just cited, he's thought to be dead as the French come onto the battlefield, and even Napoleon looks down at this fallen officer who has a banner that he has held, and he says, "A fine death, this one." And Andre, who hears him and is trying desperately to make a moan, but he can't even make his body do anything, finally a little peep comes out of him, and the French pick him up and care for him. And so he returns home later, right as his wife Lisa is dying in childbirth. Lisa, who has bored him, Lisa, whom he has wanted to flee, Lisa, whom he's regarded as a kind of shackle. And she lies there dying, and then when she is dead, her eyes say to him, "I loved you. I never hurt anyone. Look what you've done to me." This gives him a kind of lifelong sense of remorse at his blindness, at his self-centeredness. Not that he loves her anymore. He doesn't discover that he truly loved her. What he discovers is the magnitude of how much she has suffered and the kind of indifference that he has felt towards her. He becomes bitter, cynical, because he's a very ambitious man. He wants to rise up in the world, but this is a blow. And so, as he returns home and then visits others, it turns out that he meets Natasha. His falling in love with Natasha is imaged in some of the most remarkable ways by Tolstoy. And in particular, one of the passages that I like very much is the figure of a bare old oak tree that he sees in the very early spring when there are no leaves. And this again is Tolstoy. Tolstoy can give us the thoughts of a horse, and therefore he can speak for the trees. It's an old, huge, cracked bark tree. There's no springtime in it. There's no happiness in it. Springtime, of course, traditionally means happiness and sap and love, and the sap is there, but it's not yet visible. And the tree seems to speak, "Look at me with my broken, peeling fingers, wherever they care to grow." What an image. My broken, peeling fingers, wherever they care to grow. What happens in spring? But they haven't bloomed. There's no leaf. And a few months later, after seeing Natasha, he comes back and he sees, by accident, he doesn't make a visit there to see it, but he comes across exactly that same tree. And it's covered with a canopy of lush, dark foliage. And there's no trace of any gnarled fingers or scars, and succulent young leaves have burst through. And then he dances later with Natasha at the ball, which is the great romantic moment of her life, at least the first one. And he feels life. He feels a kind of rejuvenation. And he courts her, and he knows cerebrally her family is not all that interesting. She herself is the product of social arrangements that don't particularly impress him. And yet he feels in the presence of something almost holy. I quote, "as if he had emerged from a stuffy room into God's glorious daylight." It's not far from photosynthesis. This is the sunlight that makes life possible, that creates growth, and in this case, regrowth. And it's related, it seems to me, to the tree that was bare and then is in leaf. And he realizes the folly, the sterility of his political ambitions. He gives up politicking when he meets her. And so this has all the makings of a kind of romantic fiction at this point. But then his life takes a tragic curve. Natasha betrays him. I'm going to talk more about that later when I get into Natasha. And he is hurt by that. In fact, you could claim, it seems to me, that he part of him dies because of that. Very cold and arrogant and stiff and angry, wounded. Wounded emotionally, and then soon to be wounded truly and fatally at the Battle of Borodino. Even before the battle, or when he's there on the battlefield, he senses that he's going to die. He senses a kind of cold white light that bathes his life. And there too, he sees through the complex and engrossing political schemes that he has paid attention to, the ladder that he's tried to climb, the reputation he's tried to make for himself. All of this just evaporates, vanishes. He knows that something more real is about to happen. And then when he is staring at the spinning shell that is about to explode and will give him the wound that's going to kill him, once again he discovers, as he is waiting for this wound, for this explosion, he discovers the magic of life, the simple magic of life, grass, earth, air. He's wounded. It's going to be a fatal wound. His insides are sort of ruptured by the explosion of the shell. And later we find that this is, of course, the kind of romantic logic of fiction. It will turn out serendipitously that he won't die, but he will lie wounded. And when Natasha and her family exit Moscow, they bring with them a train of wounded, train in the sense of coaches carrying wounded soldiers, and Andrei is among them. It takes her a long time to know that he's there. And Tolstoy graphs this man's dying, because being wounded by the shell is only part of it. It's as if leaving life were a trajectory that you could follow. And so when Natasha finally realizes that he is there and she goes to see him, it has all of the earmarks of a lush romantic encounter. Even if he's going to die, one envisions the two lovers embracing. That's not what you get. He's already on the far side of life. He's already being weaned from life. He's already beginning to exit. And because of this, he acquires a kind of almost otherworldly serenity. There's nothing religious about this, in my point of view. It's rather a kind of dawning recognition that he's not among the living, that the kind of command, hold, grasp that life had upon him and has upon all of us as long as we live is loosening its hold and its grasp, and it's becoming more unreal. It's sort of dissipating, and instead, he's being brought elsewhere. He's gradually being transported elsewhere. He senses that he's moving into a new realm. There's a kind of serenity. It's a scary serenity. Natasha sees it, and then right before he dies, his sister Maria comes, and she's stunned, shocked, moved, I think disheartened, to see that though alive, he's also dead. He hasn't quite died. He's made peace with the world, but there's no passion left in him. He's beyond the living. The other male character, who is his counterpart, and people have said Tolstoy, in a sense, figured himself in these two figures of Andrei and now Pierre Bezukhov, whom I want to talk about. Pierre, and I'm going to give you a suite of adjectives, is big, fat, illegitimate, decent, naive, clumsy. There is nothing dashing or romantic or gallant or heroic about him. It's crucial to know that, because in the American film in the 50s made of this novel, Henry Fonda plays him. It's a bad call. It's a bad casting. And Pierre is the person who is the book's dreamer and quester. He is the illegitimate son of a very wealthy man, Count Bezukhov, and at his father's deathbed, he will, in fact, inherit the money. He's the malleable figure. He has none of the kind of immediate authority that we see in Andrei, none of the assuredness of Andrei. Instead, there's something always inquisitive, always sort of flexible, always sort of speculative about Pierre. And most people think of him almost as a buffoon. So he's not a romantic character in the least. And he is frequently, particularly at the beginning of the book, shaped by others' designs. The reason that he becomes rich has nothing to do with him. It has to do entirely with the machinations of other people who are going to benefit if Pierre inherits. And they're the ones who set up everything. They virtually script him, and he doesn't even know he's being scripted. They take him from room to room. They rush him up to his father's deathbed. They make him assume the right pose. He's embarrassed. He has no idea what to say. In general, he's not very articulate. But they set this up. It's like theatrics. And his marriage is even better. He's drawn to this woman, Hélène. She's beautiful, voluptuous. So he's drawn sensually to her. She's not particularly smart. He knows that. He's not stupid. He knows that. Nonetheless, there's a kind of radiance that she's got that he doesn't know how to resist. But because in some inward sense, he knows that maybe this isn't the right move to marry her, he sort of is paralyzed. He's there. He visits her. He pays court. He's the suitor. And there's one marvelous scene where he's sitting next to her, and Mom and Dad are in the other room, and they are waiting for him to make his proposal. And he's sort of mute. He doesn't know how to say it, and they're making small talk. And Hélène is waiting for it. Everybody's waiting for it. The reader's waiting for it. Well, Pierre doesn't come out with it. And so finally, Papa simply walks into the room, and he says, "Thank God, my wife has told me, my dear boy," as if, of course, the request for marriage had been made. And it hasn't. But it has. Daddy took care of it. That's it. It's as if it's a done deal. Likewise, he gets into situations over his head all the time. It's as if he's never a figure of any authority or governance. So he gets into a duel with this man Dolokhov, because Dolokhov is one of the lovers of Hélène. And of course, Pierre is the last person on earth, this kind of bumbling fool, to win a duel against this very, very accomplished military man. But wouldn't you know, Pierre is the one who injures him just by chance. Just happens. He sort of stumbles and trips and shoots, and he hits the guy. But before it happens, he realizes, this is insane. What am I doing here? What is he doing here? How is this kind of silly quarrel about him impugning my honor because of this woman, Hélène, whom he really doesn't love anymore, how can that possibly be related or equivalent to or an acceptable cause for the fact that one of them is going to kill the other? He's the intellectual of the book. Some of the book's most remarkable pages denote Pierre's involvement with the Freemasons, and that's a kind of really obscure cult that was very important in 19th century society in a lot of different countries. And this illustrates the mystical and idealist side of him. And it's part of Tolstoy's reach to describe the different sort of elements of his society and culture. So these are a bunch of mystics and idealists. They have very abstruse and complex symbol systems and codes. And I won't talk much about this because it's almost unreadable. It's almost indecipherable to us today. But one of the results of it is that Pierre comes to believe that he is destined, because of these obscure different sign systems, he is destined to be the person who will assassinate Napoleon. Well, that doesn't go very far, but it says something about what Tolstoy is trying to work out in this. Pierre, as I said, becomes rich because of the inheritance that he is helped into. But he's restless, he's unfocused, he doesn't know what to do with his life, and he chooses to witness the Battle of Borodino. And at first he's rather disappointed because it looks sort of chaotic, it doesn't make sense to him. All he sees is different people and different armaments and different cannons and different groups. And he's confused as the battle takes place. It's only sort of later, after the battle, in dreams that come to him, that part of the horror of this event really begins to sort of properly settle into his psyche. He is caught by the French during the siege of Moscow, and he witnesses many horrors at this point, although he is also luckily befriended by a French officer. And this is at the point where Pierre continues to evolve philosophically. He is probably the figure in the novel who grows the most. André only has these moments of illumination, whereas Pierre continues to learn and to meet people who teach him things. And so Pierre, as he sees in his state as a prisoner, he sees people being executed. He himself is almost executed. He thinks he will be. Sounds a lot like Dostoevsky's actual life, for that matter. He realizes that there is some awful, impersonal, anonymous force of necessity And when it is in play, nothing can stop it. So in other words, he's met some of the French officers who like him, who befriend him in some way, even though he's a prisoner. They know that he's a man of means and of intelligence. Nonetheless, when this it, and that's what Tolstoy calls it, this it sort of bears itself and comes into play, none of the earlier relationships or friendships, none of the earlier forms of kindness and human interest, they don't obtain anymore. They just disappear because it is going to take place. This is how Tolstoy writes it. Who was it then, when all was said and done, who was punishing him, killing him, taking his life, Pierre's life? And it's like he's thinking, this is me. I'm going to be erased. I'm going to be eradicated. With all his memories, yearnings, hopes, and ideas, all of this that's taken all of his lifetime up to now is going to be snuffed out. And not because person A or person B or person C is malevolent and is going to do it, but because of this deterministic it that drives the world, that defies comprehension. It was the way of things. It was some kind of system, he says. It's a system that no one can ever understand, however. We could call it history. We could call it fate. We could call it God if we wanted, but it's inscrutable. In his condition as prisoner, he meets this man, Platon Karatayev. My Russian is non-existent. Hope that said that halfway right. Karatayev, who is a kind of man of the people, who is a source of these remarkable stories, and who I think gives Pierre something of a religious education, not a mystical education, not at all like the Freemasons, but a religious education, a kind of Christian education about the value of suffering, a religious vision about life's own preciousness. And I think that that's where we get perhaps to the core values of this book. I'm not going to say that they are authoritative or that they govern what happens in life, but they have to do nonetheless with the kind of wisdom that Pierre is moving towards. This is how it gets summarized. Life is everything. Life is God. Everything is in flux and movement, and this movement is God. And while there is life, there is pleasure in being conscious of the Godhead. To love life is to love God. The hardest and most blessed thing is to love this life, even in suffering, innocent suffering. This is the kind of awareness, the kind of epiphany that you come to in suffering, in hardship, in seeing horrors, in seeing people being executed. As the prisoners march, he sees people drop from fatigue and they are going to be killed by the French soldiers or else left to die. And yet, because partly of his encounter with this man, Karatayev, there is a sense in which he realizes that everything is precious. Everything is imbued with the spirit, in some sense, with God's presence. It's really about presence. I sometimes think it's about what Tolstoy was doing in this novel. That you write a big, sprawling novel that touches every realm of society, that has people high and low, war and peace, drawing room battlefield, and then you realize that what's behind this is a view that all of this is life. All of this is precious. All of our customary distinctions that this is important, but that this is trivial, those distinctions are erased in this book. It's a religious book in that sense. It doesn't send us to any particular doctrine or dogma, but it says that what is most miraculous about life is what's in front of you. It's the meanest, simplest, most elemental things, including suffering, because that too is a sign of living, of experiencing. So I believe that perhaps the humanity of this book, the richness of this book, what I call the wisdom that Pierre comes to, as I say, I think it actually informs the writing. It informs the kind of design of this novel, what it is that Tolstoy is ultimately aiming at in this text, to value the life in front of you. Having befriended, and in fact adored, Natasha from the outset, even though he knows that she's in love and intending to marry his friend Andrei, Pierre is going to be reunited with her at book's end, and they will marry. I want to read you the passage about Pierre comforting the anguished and almost suicidal Natasha after the catastrophic break with André. He says to her, "If I was somebody else," remember, he's fat, big, bumbling, "if I was somebody else, the handsomest, the cleverest, the best man in the world, and if I were free, I'd be down on my knees right now, begging for your hand and your love." And he goes back home and he feels that something has changed in his life, having said that. He doesn't quite know he's in love with her. And then he looks in the sky, and what does he see in this dark sky but the brilliant comet of 1812? It's one of Tolstoy's really magic touches. This is the night that the comet comes over the Russian sky. And that passage closes that this comet seemed attuned to Pierre's newly melted heart as it gathered reassurance and blossomed into new life. I think it's perfect vintage Tolstoy, because everything that he writes has taught us to be suspicious of this connection between your private affairs and the entire cosmos and the universe. This is the kind of fiction that the book is suspicious of, and yet it's irresistible. He looks at this comet going across the sky, illuminating the dark heavens, and he thinks about this new pulsing feeling in him, having finally told Natasha that he would give anything to be the person that she loved. And then he realizes he puts them together, or at least Tolstoy puts them together. To Natasha now. She is, for many people, the most lovable, memorable figure of the novel. Decent, spoiled, hungry, restless, and always, until the very end, childlike. And yet not sugar-coated. She is spoiled. She is impetuous. She's irresistible. One of the early scenes, when she's quite young, we see her at a dinner, she keeps saying, "What's for dessert? What's for dessert?" And they can't stop her. And she's really misbehaving. And the parents are embarrassed. She won't be stopped. Her mouth is too big, and I'm being literal, not just figurative. She talks too much, but her mouth is too big as well. Her appetite for life is enormous. And we sense early on that it's going to meet with disappointments. She is delightful. Before the first ball that she goes to, she speaks to herself in the third person. She says, "Oh, she's so charming. She's so pretty. She's so clever." Like she's thinking, like, surely some man is going to realize this, going to understand this. She lives in a kind of dreamland in some ways. So when she meets Prince André, it catapults her from being a child to a woman, to a stunned woman. And she knows it. "Is this really me?" she says, when she begins to feel the extent of her affection for him. "This nice, clever man that I don't even know." And yet soon she realizes he's going to want her to marry him. She realizes that she can't go on treating life as a joke, that she has to grow up. All of this is very finely done. And yet, because of the way the plot works, she is obliged to postpone this wedding because André's father disapproves of this union and makes them postpone it, and she knows this is going to be a disaster. "What's in me now won't be there soon." And nightmare comes during the time that they wait. And it comes in the form of sexual tumult. She is going to be seduced by this very violent but dashing figure, Anatole. That's Hélène's brother. It all happens after a sequence at the opera. Reminds me a little bit of Madame Bovary. She's confused initially by the opera. What are these strange people doing? Dancing there, half-clothed. And then she sees Anatole, and all of it becomes terribly real. She feels what the applause in the room and the passion in the room itself is, all of the Russians watching the opera become sort of ecstatic with pleasure. She's feeling it in her own body. She's feeling it in this magnetic current between this man. He tries to seduce her. She's ready to do it. And then it is broken off by others who intervene, and she almost goes under. Those are the three great characters of the novel. The novel has others. We know about the families of both Natasha and André. They are unforgettable characters. They are etched in enormously fine detail. But it's these three that we remember. And we remember the curve of their life. André's move from boredom with Lisa, then to the battlefield, then to her death and childbirth, then to the discovery of Natasha and life, then to being betrayed, then to the wound, then to the exit. Or Pierre from being manipulated and then going through the path of suffering and finally offered love at the end, because finally he will be reunited with Natasha at the end. And Natasha, whose love is interrupted by a storm of sexual passion for Anatole, happiness thrown away, life lost, and at the end too, she too joins with Pierre for a form of mellow contentment. This book gives us a fabulous sense of humans on a stage that dwarfs them, and yet the beauty and integrity of their own lives nonetheless. Our antics, our dance, the world moves, we move. That's the pulse of life. Thank you.